Okay, so we're 1 week out from exam three. Exam three will cover the approximation methods that we've been dealing with, perturbation theory, Rayleigh-Ritz, and WKB, which we'll probably start talking about today. So generally speaking, I don't believe in take-home tests. And I think for various good reasons, but this particular test has been an exception occasionally in the past. So you might want to think whether you would rather do it as a take-home or as an in-class. So the usual warning, of course, is that from a professor's point of view, the take-home is harder than the in-class, right? Because I figure I get your study time plus your hour exam time. But the stuff is computationally intensive, so it doesn't really lend itself too well to an in-class. Okay, so we were talking about perturbation theory, and there were moderately complicated ideas to think about. The variational method is the simplest method, and the claim to fame of the variational method is that it provides an upper bound to the ground state and maybe the first excited state or similar sorts of states. And starts with any old function you want. Often you will want to have some adjustable parameters in there, but it's not a requirement. And then the claim is that the expectation value of the Hamiltonian is just the weighted average of the unknown values of the eigenenergies of the Hamiltonian. And of course, the average value has to be more than the smallest value. So the smallest value is what we mean by the ground state. So we're guaranteed that this quantity is greater than or equal to the energy of the ground state. If we can be sure that the coefficient of the ground state is zero in that sum, and such a situation where that might occur is if we knew, for example, that the ground state was even and then we choose a function that's odd, the same thing would apply, but now the smallest term in the sum would be the first excited state. So the same way can also occasionally give you a few excited states, not just the ground state. Inequalities, of course, aren't as interesting as equalities. And an important factoid is that this quantity is not only close to the ground state, it's quadratically close to the ground state in the way we described before. Questions? Well, let's work one more example of this before we go on to WKB. So let's think about the bouncing ball problem. So we have a particle that is trapped between the floor and some height given the force of gravity. So the force of gravity is mg. So the potential energy is mgz, and we're assuming that the floor is impenetrable. So if I plot the potential energy as a function of z, it's infinite, and then it increases linearly. And we're interested in the eigenfunctions that go along with this potential. So this potential doesn't have even odd symmetry, so we're only going to be able to get the ground state out of this. And we know that if we have an infinite potential, the value of the wave function should go to zero. So roughly speaking, we expect this wave function to look kind of like that. So our trial wave function should have those same sorts of properties. It should be equal to zero at z equals zero, and it should go to zero for large z. So I don't know, what occurs is a trial wave function that is z times e to the minus az, right? So exponentially decays for large positive z equals zero for z equals zero, and not too hard to calculate things for it. Okay, so off to the races. Well, maybe we shouldn't go off to the races quite so fast. Let's think about the units that are involved in the Schrodinger's equation. So we've got minus h bar squared over 2m, two derivatives with respect to z, plus the potential. And kind of the problem is we've got lots of dimensional things in there. And if we try and have Mathematica deal with those dimensional things, it's kind of a mess. So we'd like to figure out units that are properly scaled to the problem. So, I know, just to further simplify things, let me call those coefficients A and B. So B is a force, and in terms of its dimensions, this is going to be an energy per length. And A, since it has to give me an energy, but it's divided by length squared, it has to have the units of energy times length squared so that the length units here in the denominator cancel those and I end up with energy. So how can I take some combination of A and B to give me something that has the units of length and the units of energy? Then my plan, of course, will be that I'll have a dimensionless Z that is equal to Z divided by L, and I'll have a dimensionless energy that is the energy in joules divided by E. And hopefully, I can write this differential equation with no miscellaneous quantities sitting in it. Okay, so if I take A and B and divide them, I'll get rid of the energy unit, but I'll have a length cubed. So a good length unit is going to be A divided by B to the 1/3. And if I multiply A times B squared, I get rid of the length units. But I've got energy cubed, so I'm going to need to take the cube root of that. So if I try and scale these things out, then the derivative with respect to z prime is equal, the derivative with respect to z is equal to 1 over length, the derivative with respect to z prime, right? We said last time that you can think about that as, although they don't like it downstairs, just kind of pulling the constant L out of the derivative term. And similarly here, I can write z as equal to z prime times L. So if I do all of that, what the quantity out in front is going to be A divided by L squared. And this thing here is going to be B times L. So if we bring out what L is, right? So according to that, L is A over B to the 1/3. And 1/3, 3/3, so if I put those together, that's AB squared to the 1/3. And here I've got A and L squared in the denominator is going to be a B over A to the 2/3. So here I've got a B squared and here I've got an A. So in fact, what I have here in the end is just the energy unit derivatives with respect to the dimensionless quantities. And of course, when I divide this through, I get dimensionless energy. So long short, I can just replace all of those dimensionless quantities by ones and solve that differential equation instead. Much easier. Okay. So we said that F is going to be equal, I'm going to drop the primes now. So I'm going to need the derivatives to calculate the kinetic energy. Take the derivative of this and it just disappears. Take the derivative of that and the A comes down. So the kinetic energy term then And if I only have to integrate to zero because there's no probability of being on the other side. So integral from zero to infinity of f prime squared and of course this gets doubled because it's f prime squared. So if I expand this guy out, and I apply this integral, so this term is going to give me 0 factorial divided by 2a. Alpha is, of course, equal to 2a. And this term here is going to give me minus 2a, 1 factorial divided by 2a cubed. No, squared. And this term here is going to give me a squared 2 factorial divided by 2a cubed. Okay. So yeah, that's 1 factorial. Because I have a z to the 1. Next term I have a z to the 2. Okay, so 0 factorial is 1. These two terms exactly cancel. Here I've got 8. Here I've got 2. So this is going to give me a squared over 4a cubed, which is going to be 1 over 4a. Okay, that's the kinetic energy term. The normalization term's easier. So I've got 2 factorial divided by 2a cubed. And for the potential energy, I just need to put in the function of z. So it's going to be like this, except now with an extra power of z. So this is going to be 3 factorial divided by 2a to the fourth. So if we put all of those terms together, we've got a, so this is again the expectation value of the Hamiltonian divided by the normalization. We've got the kinetic energy, which in the end was 1 over 4a. We've got the potential energy, which in the end, so we've got 3, 8, a to the fourth. Oops, 3. And then we've got for the normalization, this. Okay, so here what we're going to get is a squared, and here we're going to get a 3 halves over a. So in terms of what this function looks like, as a goes to 0, it goes to infinitely high. As a goes to some positive value, it goes quadratically. So clearly there's going to be a minimum. Standard way of finding minimums is to take the derivative, set it equal to 0. So what we're going to have is, so 0 equals 2a minus 3 over 2a squared. So if we set these things equal to each other, we've got a equals 3 over 4 a squared, and finally a cubed is equal to 3/4. Okay, so we can take that value of a, and with our calculators we can plug it into this formula, And if you do that, what you get is an energy that is equal 2.476. And that's guaranteed to be above the actual ground state energy. And the problem is actually solvable exactly in terms of what are called Airy functions. And the exact eigen energy is 2.338. Okay, so about 4% high or something like that. So not bad for a simple approximation. Okay, questions?
So over here you said 1 = 0.
Zero factorial?
Yeah.
Yep, zero factorial is 1.
Divided by 29.
That's 2a.
2a, okay.
Yeah, the things that look like 9s are a's.
What did you do to solve for the KV and the PE?
So the kinetic energy is this. And what Kyle was asking about before class, what we showed, integration by, you might have expected second derivatives of that function, right? But integration by parts tells us that that is that. And this one is easier to calculate because it doesn't require calculating second derivatives. So pretty much always use that trick.
Okay. And then for the PE?
So the PE, the only thing that's different here is I wanted to include the potential, right? And the potential is just Z. So that's why I've got Z cubed. Abramowitz is the name of the book I used. So the functions that are solution to this are called Airy functions. Airy is a famous dead physicist, and it turns out that the energies are the zeros of the Airy function. And what's the Airy function? The Airy function turns out to be exactly what solves that differential equation. I think he used it actually to solve the rainbow problem. So Airy, I don't know, astronomer, optics, circa 1850, British.
He solved the rainbow problem?
Yeah, I think he solved, there are lots of rainbow problems, but I think he solved one of them. One that actually did it in terms of wave optics as opposed to simple stuff. So you could ask Dean about that. Dean must know about Airy functions. Okay. So I don't know, let's do, so these things become kind of too complicated to do on the board, but it's important. This is a really, really commonly used method to get really good values. So far we haven't put in very complicated functions, so we've been 10% off, 5% off, depending upon how hard we worked. I guess that's probably too much off, huh? So if we think about a real hard problem, one of them is H minus. Okay, so as H minus is the same thing as helium, but with just one proton on the inside as opposed to two. And historically, this was an interesting and important problem because it turns out that models of how the sun work don't work if you don't include H minus. And it turns out that you can't make H minus in the lab easily, right? So if you took chemistry, they never mentioned H minus. But it's a perfectly good, so this problem shows that it's a perfectly good bound state. So if you've got H minus, what have you got? You've got a nuclear attraction between one electron and the nucleus, nuclear attraction of the other electron and the nucleus, and the interaction energy between the two electrons. And of course, that's the hard part, right? That's 1 over the separation between those two. But all we have to do is to plug in a function and take derivatives and do integrals. So it turns out that Beta, who won a Nobel Prize, but not particularly for this, is the guy who came up with a pretty easy function for doing all of this. So here is the calculation that you need to do, right? There's the interaction term. These are the two Hamiltonians. Here's some of the easy part. Well, if we think about what you would want for a function, the electrons are fermions, so we have to have a function that is symmetric under exchange of R1 and R2. So that's why we have this symmetric combination. So these things are exponentially decaying, but with different exponents for one electron and the other. And the other thing we might want to make it is to make the function be big when the separation between the electrons is big, right? Because then it's going to be small when the separation is small, and that's the interaction energy. So this is the trial wave function that Beta came up with. And I've done it. There's the integrals you get, right? Here's the divided by. So all of this is normalization, and the rest of this is kinetic energy plus potential energy. So all we have to do is find the minimum of this function. And that's guaranteed to be more than the actual solution to the problem. And in these dimensionless units, the energy of the normal hydrogen atom is minus a half. So the question is whether this is more bound. Is this less than minus a half? Okay, so I mean, this is what Mathematica is good for. So I can take this formula for the energy, and I can copy and paste this into Mathematica. Now, remember that we need some sort of guess as to some sort of starting guess for these parameters A, B, and C. With just one parameter, we could plot the value of the energy versus A and see what the minimum is. With two parameters, you could conceivably make a contour plot, right? So you would put one parameter on the y-axis, one parameter on the x-axis, and you would plot the value of the function on top of that xy plane. But here we have a cube, right? A, B, and C can all change. How can we kind of see where the minimums are? So we can actually make a table of all of those values. We can do, I don't know, I forget how many there are, lots of contour plots. I guess I didn't. So here are lots of contour plots. So red is small and blue is big. And this is kind of wrapping around there. So this kind of mask is where the function is relatively low. It's lowest here, you go uphill here, you go all the way uphill there. And if you look at where that function is about as small as it's going to get, it's about in here. Here we have about as much of this orange as we can possibly get, so that means that we've got more. Here it's still red there, so here we've got the lowest of the possible lows. So that, I don't know, that's a little bit, it's a little bit hard to deal with all of those at once. So kind of a better option is to look at the data cube interactively. So what I'm doing here, so I think the y-axis is A and the other one's B. And what I'm doing is cycling through various cuts. So you can watch this dark eye, it grows and then it shrinks. Where it's as big as possible, that's where the, right about there, that's where the energy is going to be the smallest. Okay, so we're looking at cuts of a data cube to find the minimum. And with those, I can get a good starting guess as to what it is. And I don't know, there's the final answer that find minimum got me. It says it's protected. But that is the minimum. And you can see it's a little bit more than minus 1/2. So H minus is bound. And if we work it out, it's bound by about 3/4 of an electron volt. And it turns out that that's exactly the binding energy that was required in order to make models of the sun work properly in the 50s. Okay, so in general, the real plan is not to have one parameter, the real plan is to have lots of parameters. So soon after Beta did this, somebody else published one with 24 adjustable parameters. There are programs these days that have hundreds of adjustable parameters in order to do the best possible job for minimizing the energy. Okay. Okay, so variational method is the easiest method. The middling hard method is WKB approximation. And as usual, WKB stands for some dead physicist, Wenzel, Kramers, and Brillion. Wenzel is my grandfather. That is to say, my major professor's major professor was W. So, of course, we have to do WKB approximation. So the equation we're trying to solve, minus h bar squared over 2m, two derivatives of x, plus a potential, this time psi is going to be e psi. And kind of the plan is to make this differential equation look like the simplest differential equation you know, which I would claim is psi double prime is minus omega squared psi, right? The problem that is simple harmonic oscillator. So, of course, we can't make Schrodinger's equation be a simple harmonic oscillator. So when I say look like, it's not going to be exactly like this. And in particular, this thing's not going to be a constant. So you can think about it as kind of where the frequency depends on time. How's that going to change things? Okay, so if I go about and do this, I'm going to get minus h bar squared over 2m, two derivatives with respect to x, is equal to the energy minus the potential. So I'll bring that last term over. In fact, let's just use double derivatives. So this quantity, it's not a constant, depends on x, but instead of writing it like that, I'm just going to write it as k squared. And I'm thinking about k as being a real number because I'm thinking about the energy being more than the potential energy, right? So if this is the potential energy and this is the energy, we have the idea of the allowed region and the disallowed region. So I'm thinking about, I won't hold myself to this in the future, but currently I'm thinking about k as being a real number because I'm thinking about figuring out the value of psi in the allowed region, which is where psi is going to be the biggest, right? It's not going to be particularly likely to find the particle in the disallowed region. Okay, so the solution to this guy was e to the i omega t. So here time is x. So kind of your first guess of what the solution would be something like e to the i k times x. But k isn't a constant, and so that makes kind of a big difference. And really what we want here is something more like the integral of k dx. In any case, we're going to have oscillations because we have e to the I something. And the local wave number of those oscillations is going to be k. So, I don't know, we might be barking up the right tree. So I can't guess that. So without loss of generality, any function psi can be written like that. All you have to do is take the logarithm of psi. So any function in the world can be written like that. So without loss of generality, I can assume that that's the form for psi. And I can plug it in here and see what I learn by doing that. Okay, so if this is psi, then psi prime is equal to, well, this thing is going to come down with the derivative. So this is going to be I s prime e to the I s. And then psi double prime is going to be I s double prime e to the I s. So that's if I take the derivative of the first term. Otherwise, I'm going to get I s squared e to the I s. Okay, so if I plug that in, that's what the differential equation has to solve. So I've got I s double prime minus s squared. Oops, there's a prime there. Minus s prime squared has to be minus k squared. Well, so the thing that was s before, right, s is kind of this. And it certainly has a first derivative. That would have been just omega. But if omega is a constant, there wouldn't have been a second derivative. So I'm going to argue that this is small, at least a first order approximation, in which case s prime is going to be equal to k, plus or minus k, if we want to care about it. And that means that s is plus or minus the integral of k of x dx. You might remember that that's kind of what I argued I would find. Okay, well, what works once, one can try it again with this sort of further approximation. So let's let s be, and let's pick a sign here. Let's let s be that, where epsilon is some unknown function. And again, this is without loss of generality. That's to say, any wave function can be written like that, where epsilon is whatever it turns out to be. So I haven't made any approximations yet. This is a 100% correct statement. Okay, so with this for s, then s prime is going to be k plus epsilon prime, and s double prime is going to be k prime plus epsilon double prime. And all I need to do is to plug these guys in here and see what I get. So I've got I times k prime plus epsilon double prime minus k plus epsilon prime squared is equal to minus k squared. And of course, by design, I have a big cancellation, right? This guy is going to cancel that guy. So I've got I k prime plus epsilon double prime minus, again, there's that cancellation, so I've got minus 2k epsilon prime plus epsilon prime squared. Okay, so now I do make an approximation. I'm going to say that this term is small as the second derivative of something that's small, and I'm going to claim that this term is small because it's second order. So with those approximations, what I've got then is, well, we can put this term, the remaining negative term on the other side of the equation. So I've got I k prime is equal to 2k epsilon prime. So epsilon prime is going to equal I k prime over 2k. So again, remember k is a known function, right? So k is that energy minus potential energy with some stuff. This thing here, if you think about it, it's I over 2, the natural logarithm of k prime. So apparently, epsilon equals I over 2, natural logarithm of k prime plus a constant. Well, the constant doesn't do anything, right? If I add a constant to S, it just adds an overall phase factor to psi. And so an overall phase factor, and you can take any wave function and multiply it by any number, and it's a perfectly good solution again. So the constant is of no great consequence. How about this term? So what we've got then is psi is equal to e to the I, the integral out to x of k of x dx, plus we've got this term here, I over 2, natural logarithm, there's no prime here anymore, right? Because I took the antiderivative of that, natural logarithm of k. Well, that half, I can put it inside the logarithm, right? If I take that k to the 1/2, and then e to the anything logarithm is just exponential and logarithm are inverse functions of each other. So let's rewrite what we've got then. So we've got e to the I integral out to x of k of x dx, and then we've got I times I is minus. So this is equal to 1 over the square root of k of x e to the I integral of k of x dx. So what do these solutions look like? That's really kind of one of the main purposes of WKB, is to understand what the wave function physically looks like. So if I have this is the potential and this is the energy, and remember that k is equal to 2m over h bar squared e minus v to the 1/2. Oops, the square root goes inside of that too. So if we just limit ourselves to some little range here, let's say we go from x to delta x. So this quantity, the extra bit, I go by going some distance delta x. This is going to be, say, the integral from 0 to x of this quantity, which is just some constant. Then I'm going to have the integral from x to x plus delta x of k of x dx. And I can approximate that, right? This is just some small distance, as just the function times the distance I go. Okay, so approximately speaking, this thing, if I just take a step that's delta x, this is going to be e to the I k delta x. So what's the interpretation of k? I don't know, it might help to bring back that relationship. So, I mean, we're typically happier to have h bar multiplying something. So if I bring that back, I've got h bar k is equal to the square root of 2m e minus v. So what is E minus V physically? It's kinetic energy. And the formula for kinetic energy, since mechanics, is? Well, it was 1 half mv squared in 191, but we kind of like p squared over 2m better. So h bar k is the momentum, and that's the way it's pretty much always been. What's different is, I think before when you were using k's, they were constant. This k isn't a constant. It depends on position, just like the momentum depends on position. So what did de Broglie have to say about the relationship between momentum and other things? No, that was Heisenberg. De Broglie's before Heisenberg.
It's like how they're related. It's H bar over P or H bar over M.
So I think it's H over P. So what we've got here is something like the wavelength, right? So if I take my equation and rearrange it a little bit, I've got h over p is 2 pi over k. So k is like the inverse wavelength. So the wavelength depends on position. And where k is small, I have a long wavelength. And where k is big, I have a short wavelength. OK, so what's the wavelength here, big or small? So it's low kinetic energy, which is to say low momentum, and low momentum corresponds to what in terms of wavelength?
Big wavelength.
Big wavelength, right? So how about here? What's the wavelength here? Small. So, And I'm going to run into this spot here where, again, I'm going to have a long wavelength, right? So here we've got big K, small lambda, and here we've got small k, big lambda. But there's a little bit more information we have, right? So I drew these things as having pretty much the same amplitude, but there's a k here. So not only should I have a small wavelength here, I should have a small amplitude there. Right? So this thing should look more kind of like that. Does this make sense? Why should the amplitude be big where the k is small?
Conservation of like energy. Because when the wavelength is small, wouldn't the energy be high?
So the kinetic energy be high if the wavelength is small. So that's just rerunning this argument. But I'm looking for a different argument. Why should the amplitude, not the wavelength, why should the amplitude be big where k is small? So what's the difference between big amplitude and small amplitude? Yeah, so what this is saying is I'm likely to find the particle here, but I'm unlikely, relatively speaking, to find the particle there. Does that make sense? And if so, explain it to me.
If you're thinking about it like classically, it would take longer for the like ball or whatever to go over that place where there's a peak. So it would be moving slower in that area.
Yeah, so it's moving slower there, so it's more likely to be found there. And if you work out the physical mechanics of it, the probability of finding something there should be inversely proportional to the velocity. And that's exactly what we're going to have, right? Because psi star psi is going to have 1 over k. K is basically the momentum. So we're going to get 1 over the velocity. So that's all just basically classical mechanics. So WKB is just a differential way of kind of explaining de Broglie, right? So we've got the amplitude factor, which we get from classical mechanics. We've got the wavelength, which depends on position because the momentum depends on position. All is a way of approximating the wave function. Okay, so let's repeat the important factoid. So psi is approximately equal to 1 over the square root of k, which depends on position, e to the I integral of k of x dx. And what this factor is saying is that the local wavelength it's going to be 2 pi over k. I mean, that's what that mathematics is saying. And this factor here is saying that we get a big amplitude when it's moving slow. Now, I did all of this work arguing that that we were in the classically allowed region where the energy was more than the potential. How do things change if I'm in the classically disallowed region where the potential is more than the energy? So if the potential is more than the energy, then this is a negative number under the radical. And that means that this k is complex. And so let me write it explicitly as being a complex number. Let me write it as k times, and it's hard to tell the difference between kappas and k's, but I mean that to be a kappa. And if I plug that in here, what I get is 1 over the square root of kappa, e to the plus minus integral of kappa d dx. I get exponentially growth or decay, right? So here, what you know I want is exponential growth, and here you know what I want is exponential decay. So the one place I can't do WKB is right at the turning point, right at the classical turning point. Right, that would give me a zero in the denominator. That's always a bad idea. But we do know that at the classical turning point, the function should be big because the velocity is small there. And so if we have something like a simple harmonic oscillator wave function, what this thing should look like it's kind of like that. And if you go look at the pictures in your book, they'll of course look a lot nicer than that, but they'll show that behavior where we have a short wavelength here and a small amplitude and a long wavelength here and a big amplitude and exponential behavior as we go into the classically disallowed region. Okay, so it's nice to approximate wave functions, but it's even better to approximate energies, because energies are usually what we can measure. Yes?
We have h bar k is equal to p. Is it I h bar kappa is equal to p? Where does the h bar go?
Oh, yeah, there's still an h bar there. Yep. But there's no h bar in this formula. The units of k have disappeared. Incidentally, I think if I recall correctly, our textbook actually puts h bars around and uses p's. But I really dislike that. I like to have things that have more obvious units than h bar. So now let's go back to Bohr's model. Right? Bohr was wrong, but he was right on a lot of things. He won his Nobel Prize in turn, even though everything he said was wrong, because there was a certain amount of rightness to it. So Bohr said that wave functions work by having an integer number of wavelengths. Right? That was the start of the hydrogen atom. Count the number of wavelengths that go around in a circle. Apply de Broglie's relationship, crank away, and you get Bohr's equation for the energies. So how many wavelengths are there between this turning point and that turning point? How do I add them up? Well, I've got this exponential, right? So apparently it must be that the integral of k of x dx has to be some integer multiple of pi. That's exactly what be, from one turning point, that's exactly what it would mean to have an integer number of wavelengths. Right? Remembering that k is 2 pi over the wavelength, so the pi's go away, we're all set. This formula can't be, or maybe I should say typically, is not exactly correct. And what's not exactly correct about it is it would be saying that this graph should look like this, where I reach zero at the ends. But you know you don't reach zero at the ends, right? You connect to this disallowing piece. So there's not exactly an integer number of wavelengths. There's some wavelength that's being left out on the side. And it turns out, and it's a long story which is in the book and I'm not sure I'm going to talk about, because the answer is simple. The answer is that basically it's 45 degrees that's being left out. There's 45 degrees here and there's 45 degrees there. You kind of come halfway down. And then you connect to the exponential. So if I add together 245 degrees, I get 90 degrees, which is pi over 2. So the phase that I want to have, wherever I wrote it, where did I write it? I knew I wrote it someplace. Well, I'm looking for, I can probably rewrite it as fast as I can find it, but boy, did I erase it? Did I write it and erase it? Or is it all just in my mind? Someplace there's an N on this board. Ah, there, thank you. So I need to subtract 90 degrees, which is pi over 2, because I have 45 degrees at each end. So we'll spend a lot of time talking about that detail. And I guess I would comment that not uncommonly you will see this written, and not uncommonly you'll see that written. And it's the difference between whether you think of n as starting at 1 or n as starting at 0, right? N was an integer. Okay, so this detail, how we connect up through the classical turning points, that's the topic of a lot of pages in the book, and I'll spend some time arm-waving about it, but the proof, incidentally, the proofs involve area functions, so it would be a good excuse to spend time on area functions, but I don't intend to take that opportunity. Okay, so